never been sort of a museum in a sense. It's always been a family home. It's always had activity. So it's always been a very alive space that I think is reflecting the world around. I think anybody that works at Blenheim, the second you sort of are stepping across the landscape, it's everything. It all has such a power on you.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Country Life Podcast with me, your host, James Fisher. Today, I am joined by an extremely exciting guest who is Emily Spencer, who is the head of operations at Blenheim Palace. Hello, Emily.
Hi there, James.
How are you doing today?
Yes, very good today. The sun is out for the first time in a while, so it's looking quite pretty at Blenheim.
Yeah, and I've heard it's quite a pretty looking place. How long have you been working at Blenheim?
So it's just over 5 years for me. So a year before sort of COVID, a few interesting years across COVID, and then sort of lots of activity since then.
Very cool. So what? Why don't we start with a bit about yourself? What sort of happens in the daily life of the head of operations at Blenheim Palace? It's quite a big building to look after, isn't it?
It's a big building, and we have quite a big team looking after it as well, because we are really here to sort of welcome everybody, you know, through the doors and give everybody a great day out. So on any given day, it can be quite different. But the main aims are to be set up in the morning, to get the team in position, communicate the plan of the day, and ensure that everything is spick and span and everything looks fantastic for the first arrivals. Because we can expect, particularly now over the Easter holidays, you know, we could be having 5,000-6,000 people coming through our doors in the morning. So it's making sure everything's ready to go. The cafes are set and ready to welcome people. And we've got enough parking planned. And from that point on, then hopefully the offer flows from there.
Yeah, yeah. Just make sure the tea room is full of cakes and there's somewhere to park and people will turn up. Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
So what kind of sort of experiences have you come across in your 5 years at Blenheim Palace? I mean, are you often sort of pulling children out of rooms they shouldn't be in? Are you sort of...
Oh, yes. There's always... Every day probably has a story behind it. We could write quite a lot of books probably. Yes, I mean, you set up everything, but of course, when you're welcoming lots of people, everybody wants to see slightly different things and interesting things happen. I think not pulling children out of lakes, luckily, but certainly pulling cars out of fields. I think with the weather we've seen in the last few weeks, we had a very busy Easter, which was fantastic, and we had some lovely feedback from guests. But I won't pretend that we managed to park everybody on hard standing. We had to use a few fields and we had to use a few tow bars as well. Yeah, so always fun though.
Well, it's good service, at least you didn't just leave the cars
there. We didn't leave them. Nobody's still stuck there.
Yeah,
so
no, I don't think Capability Brown had sort of, stranded cars in his grand visions for the landscape.
Don't think so.
So, I mean, have you always been, when you sort of applied for the role at Blenheim Palace, was it something like you've always wanted to work in a grand country house such as this one, or is it sort of something you sort of came into?
Yes, well, I've always loved history and I've always wanted to work sort of at visitor attractions and with the public. And I'm an Oxfordshire person as well. So I guess it was a natural thing perhaps to come to Blenheim at some stage. But yeah, just very much interested in presenting historic sites in a way that is appealing to a wide range of people and ensuring that they have a fantastic day out when they visit. That's really what I'm interested in. And with that, I get to meet and work with fantastic people who have particular skills and interests that, make the offer what it is. So, yeah, it's been my entire career, really, pretty much for the last 20 years.
And do you remember the first time you saw Blenheim? Did you visit as a child or?
Yeah, I think so. I think nobody can forget that, really. So I visited as a child and I think those memories are probably from seeing it from the outside, seeing sort of the Grand Bridge, seeing the views across, the finest view in England, and visiting it, with family and friends, particularly sort of the events. I seem to remember coming to perhaps some battle proms and things in my younger years. Yeah. And obviously now I'm here, we're at the heart of all that. We're running and looking after the events and don't miss any of it.
What's a battle prom, if you don't mind me asking?
A battle prom is one of the events we have towards the north of the park. So that's sort of music and entertainment, fly pass, just a fantastic event that we hold in July.
Oh, very cool.
One of many.
And is it happening in July this year?
It will be hot after lots of other events. So we've got a whole packed schedule this summer. All the usual favourites. We've got the flower show, the food festival. We've got our jousting coming up in May. And later on this summer, we have the game fair returning to the Palace Estate. That's the first time in a few years. So yeah, that's really exciting.
Yeah. Oh, that is very exciting. And I'm sure some of our listeners will definitely be heading down to that. What's it like filling in a health and safety form for jousting?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because you're always working with professionals. So yeah, there's a lot of trust and experience. We've done it so many years. It's there's a lot of sort of trust in what they do, but we always come at it fresh. You always got to be prepared. Again, you know, is the ground the same as it was last year? Do the horses need a bit more space? You know, what's the size of the audience? It was interesting over COVID because we had to turn it on its head a bit and have time slots to visit the joust, and that's now gone, and we're back to having a really big open space with lots of entertainment and lots of activity around it. So I think this year is probably bigger and better than ever.
Very good. Well, we'll come back to COVID. I just want to focus a bit on Blenheim Palace itself. I mean, I'm sure plenty of our listeners will know lots about it, but could you tell us a bit about the house, its history?
Certainly. I mean, as an overview, really, it's like, you know, with such incredible history. As people probably know, John Churchill won the Battle of Blenheim in 1704, was gifted the land, the finances to build the palace, and with his wife Sarah sort of leading that with the architect John Vanbrugh, the palace was created then from sort of 1705 through to sort of the early 1730s. It's a lavish monument to the battle. It's, you know, a monument to the Queen Anne at the time, and it's a home for the Marlborough family, and it's been that all the way through to today. We still are a home for the Marlborough family, and we opened our doors to the public in 1950. So we've also been very much welcoming everybody to come and visit us and enjoy us since then on a daily basis.
Very nice. And it's one of the only non-royal, non-episcopal houses to hold the title of palace. Do you know why that is?
It is. Well, it all goes back to that original sort of the reason for it being built, really. It was gifted by the Queen, and sort of has been in the possession of the family since then. We do have to give over a quit rent every year to the royal family. Well, you could take that to Windsor every year, just as our, that allows us to retain Blenheim as it is, and makes it unique. And a very special place it is indeed.
And how much is the rent? Did you say a quid?
A quit rent is actually just a little flag.
A little flag.
Yes. Okay. A little flag that's dated that we take off as our gift. And we have an example one actually in the palace. I think it dates to about the 1940s. So we seem to have a spare there as well.
Oh, yeah. Just in case.
Absolutely.
And so something like that flag, for example, there's a Blenheim have just opened a new exhibition, which is basically all about the contents of the home, a permanent exhibition. Would something like that be in it?
Yes, in fact, we've got a new quit rent arriving soon to go in the exhibition, just to showcase exactly what it is that we would share. Yeah, I mean, it's for us, it's really exciting actually to open the Blenheim story, because as much as we have so many stories to tell and so much to see and such a broad collection, actually, I think we were conscious that with so many guests coming, there's a lot that sort of takes over very quickly. It's so awe-inspiring. I think it's quite easy to get lost in the detail and perhaps leave after a very fun-filled day and a very sort of informative day, but perhaps not really understand the basics of why Blenheim is here and what the battle was and who was involved. So our intention there really was to open an exhibition that sets people up then for the rest of their experience around the palace. And we had an opportunity with a couple of rooms within the palace itself that had not been used for a few years, but fit the guest routes. That allowed us to create an exhibition that naturally sort of fits the flow. You come into the palace, you go into the Great Hall, then you experience the story of Blenheim, and then you're set up with all that sort of basic information to enjoy the detail that then follows from the guides in the rooms.
And have you seen the exhibition?
Yes, we opened it on Friday of Easter, so Good Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had close to 20,000 people probably coming through over those days within the sort of the palace and courtyards. And so it was tested very quickly over its opening weekend. And I think hopefully people are really appreciating it. It just hopefully is setting people up and giving them that overview that I think is really helpful. And of course, then it opens up and leaves all the staterooms to be as powerful and as, you know, impressive as they can be. And then with the audio guide and with the actual guides in the rooms, all the broader information can follow from there. So yes, we're really pleased with it.
Is there anything in the exhibition you saw that you didn't know beforehand?
I think so. I think just the basic story actually brought out some, you know, just some detail I probably wasn't aware of. I probably, for the first time in 5 years, really got my head around sort of from the battle through to perhaps the building of the Triumphal Arch and the monument to the first Duke, sort of exactly all the how all the dates fit. And I think I benefited from that, and I'm sure pretty much everybody else visiting will too. And as I say, if you like your sort of deeper detail, then that's what the guides are there to offer. They're very keen to give much more information, and it allows them to really get into specific details that are relevant to each individual guest.
Very nice. And so how many guides do you currently have working at the palace?
Oh, we have a team of probably about 60 guides who work across the season. So they are, we probably on any given day might have 10 to 12 across the palace and exhibitions. They are in the main state rooms, but they also support us by giving a bit more history in our Churchill exhibition and in our stables exhibition. They might lead a garden tour, they might lead a buggy tour. So they are very flexible and a really fantastic team of people who are so very passionate about the history.
I imagine running Blenheim Palace is about protecting the collections within the building, you know, the building itself. How much of your work is based on just, you know, keeping the palace standing up? Without sounding too ridiculous myself,
no.
I've got a couple of friends who've got big country houses, and it basically takes up their entire lives trying to stop the thing from falling down. And Blenheim Palace is much, much bigger than any of those houses. It must be quite the operation.
It is, and I think it's one of our 10 goals to complete £40 million of restoration work over a 10-year period. And that is because we need to, because it is a living, breathing building. It is, you know, suffering from sort of the weather, the randomness of, you know, heavy rain and frost and things, just as any other building would do. And there's a huge plan to sort of get the restoration work done and bring it back to, you know, the best it can be. And we do that by being open, by, you know, allowing people to come in, and, you know, the money they spend, and particularly, you know, when they gift aid their tickets as well, all that funding comes back to the palace and allows us to do that restoration. And they're not small sums of money, you know. It's we've recently completed our chapel restoration. We recently completed the orangery. Again, we're talking a few million pounds involved there. We dredged our lake a couple of years ago. That was, I think, around 7 million to dredge the lake just to allow the water to return to the right levels. And very soon, in the next couple of years, we'll be embarking on a roof project, which will be probably in excess of 10 million to ensure that we don't have buckets collecting water coming in our roof tiles, which actually we have at present. So, you know, it's an ongoing battle, of course, like anybody's home is, really. You've got to keep the maintenance up, and ours is no different. It's just on a very big scale. And that's our reasoning for, you know, that's why we, you know, we do open ourselves up. We try to, you know, to ensure we get that revenue in and we put it to the right ends as well.
Well, I think, I mean, it's one of the rich English traditions is, you know, repairing leaky roofs in this part of the world. So, you know, I'm glad to hear that Blenheim Palace is no stranger to such a situation as well.
Not at all.
Yeah. I've also got some DIY planned this weekend, but fingers crossed it might come in a shade under 10 million quid. But you never know.
Good luck.
Thank you. The lake. That was a very interesting and cool project that I heard about. Can you tell us a bit about the sort of plan to dredge it? Because, you know, I saw the before and after pictures, and before it just looked like a muddy swamp, and now it's this amazing, beautiful thing.
Yes, I mean, I guess it was sort of planned probably when I arrived. It was something that was on the agenda. And only over the course of the first year, probably getting used to Blenheim, did I realise just what it actually meant that the lake was so shallow. So much so much silt had come through the water channels into the lake that in areas, I think it was, you know, only a matter of so many centimetres deep.
Yeah.
And we were seeing sort of, you know, green algae type coverage and all sorts of sort of worries with it. It was a huge undertaking, very much by our estates team, to seek out the best way to do the dredging. They went with a wet dredge in the end, which meant that we had diggers on the surface of the lake, digging in, taking out the silt. That then was sort of carried to the side of the lake and ultimately moved to a land sort of mass, a landform on our wider estate. So it was all sort of retained within the walls of Blenheim, and it was all done whilst we remained open. And the the impact now is that we have this beautiful lake that just shines, you know, in good weather, and is much better for the habitat, just much better all around, and hopefully will see us through until we perhaps might need to do another dredge in 150 years time. But, you know, connected to the dredge, obviously the team have been working on sort of the waterways north of the park as well to ensure that that level of silt doesn't perhaps come down in the same way in the future.
Yeah, it's sort of like painting the fourth bridge, isn't it? Once you fix the lake, you fix the roof, and then fix everything else, and then it's
and then
back.
We start again, probably. Yes.
Oh, very exciting. So what sort of are the modern pressures that Blenheim is facing, not just sort of, you know, wind and weather, but, you know, you read a lot about sort of country homes and their relationship to Britain's colonial past and the various things that happened during that time. How has that affected Blenheim, especially, say, you know, the most recent exhibition of Blenheim's history that you've just put on?
Yes, I think, you know, we're very keen to sort of make sure we always do our research and present things as accurately as possible. Mm. I think, you know, that story is very much a story of sort of the War of Spanish Succession and the success of a military battle. And ultimately, that is where sort of the funding for the palace came from. But I'm sure as you look into the collection, and you know, there will always be stories behind items that over time we will look to, you know, perhaps go into more deeply and look for different reflections on. And I think that's something that we already try and do in different ways. We have the Blenheim Art Foundation, who puts on an exhibition in the palace usually annually. They bring in an artist later this summer, Mohamed Sami, who does sort of reflections on sort of wider world conflicts. And I think it's really important that we're always looking, you know, outside our walls to recognise, you know, how we can have a positive impact and how we can reflect on, you know, the collection we're sharing. And that's something that we try and do, I think, both in terms of the collection we have in the palace and the way the estate works with the local community. I think that's really important to us.
Is it a difficult balancing act, sort of keeping the history and the story of something like Blenheim on one side and also trying to keep it a sort of modern, interesting venue for visitors to come and visit?
It doesn't feel like it, because I think we've always been alive. I think we've never been sort of a museum in a sense. It's always been a family home. It's always had activity from the moment it opens its doors. I think, you know, it was hosting fashion exhibitions within the first sort of 10 years or so. So it's always been a very alive space that I think is reflecting the world around. I think, you know, something we're really proud of at the moment, we have our Icons of British Fashion exhibition that we opened in the palace a couple of weeks ago, and that's going to run to the end of June. And that is an exhibition where we're reflecting sort of British designers, really key British designers of sort of the last 50, 60 years. And something like that, I think, gives us a sort of a nod to the world beyond, and also kind of almost enhances what we have in the rooms themselves. So, yeah, I think we're always looking at ways, whether it's in the palace or the way we work with the local community, and, you know, what we're looking to do perhaps to, you know, work with solar to ensure that we're being as green as we can be, you know, trying to get to net zero. All of these things are a part of that mission, to be sort of the lifeblood of the local community and not exist solely as a little island with, you know, big fences around.
Even though there are some big fences around.
Yes, but there's also a lot of access points and entry points where people can come in, get their annual pass and enjoy a full season with us.
Very good, very good. So, yeah, I just want to focus a bit more on that idea of sustainability, because obviously when Blenheim Palace was built, concept of global warming, and indeed, I mean, I guess the industrial age as a concept had not existed. So how, you know, working within the confines of a Grade 1 listed heritage building, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, in fact, what's it like trying to sort of get to net zero?
It's actually a really exciting mission, because it's one that I think everybody at Blenheim is very much behind. And we recognise the reasons to do it. I think we realise, you know, already just our grounds are very wet. We've had nothing but rain for the last few months. We know the impact of that. I think when Vanbrugh designed the palace, the channels for the rainwater, these days, they struggle to cope with it, because the rain comes very heavily when it comes. And so, you know, we recognise very, very, you know, obviously the reason for trying to, you know, manage that impact. Lots of little things we're doing, some, you know, that I think are where the guests are really helping us as well. So Something we've introduced this year are our returnable cups. We don't have any takeaway cups that go into landfill anymore. We have returnable cups that guests are given on site. They can then return them to us in little scannable bins. It just means that our landfill from that is now gone, which is fantastic. And I think that's quite innovative and hopefully something that people will see more widely over time. We give the option if people visit us to offset their visit by purchasing a tree. We've been planting large numbers of trees on the estate. And just practically as a team, you know, we're looking at how we heat the palace. We're on conservation heating that's best for the collection. It also helps us to maintain, you know, a sensible level of heating across the season and, you know, lighting levels, things like that. We're very careful just to monitor. We set targets for the team. Lots of different ways we approach this. We've also got a little solar field that's being set up as a bit of a test where we're not only looking at what that can bring back to the palace, but we're looking at how that impacts that area of sort of ground. What does that mean for the longer term use of that, you know, the wider sort of landscape, really? And what does it mean for the bugs and the bees and the creatures that live there? Actually, by having that focus there, does that actually improve and enhance the soil? And these are all sort of things that our estates team are looking at and can probably give a far more detailed answer than I can on that. But it's very exciting.
Is that something, you know, the results of which you would share with other sort of historic homes around the country?
Absolutely. So there's been some great collaboration across the Treasure Houses and the wider Historic Houses Association. I think everybody sort of looks to each other to learn, you know, what's being done well, what is effective, what are the challenges. And the best way to learn is just to work together always. And I think there's a lot of collaboration wherever possible.
You talk about planting trees. You've planted a lot of, am I right in thinking, English willow trees recently?
Yes. I think that's some of the recent ones. Again, I'm sure our head forester would be able to tell me all the specifics, but certainly, yes, we've been helping. And then the team have been doing it, helping the team to do it. So we're not just the foresters, but actually we've been having sort of days for the staff on site to get involved in planting the trees. And that makes it feel very real as well. So it's something I think we're all involved in.
So you started working at Blenheim in 2019, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And then you sort of barely got your feet under the desk when the pandemic rolled into town, for want of a better description. What was it like working in the palace those sort of two years?
Yeah, I mean, it was just so interesting because 2019 was such a busy year. I think we had, you know, one of our record numbers for guests on site, record numbers of events. And then, of course, suddenly you get to sort of February, March 2020, and it suddenly all stopped. But actually, looking back on those years, it certainly wasn't a sense we were either sat twiddling our thumbs or, you know, waiting. It was a really innovative time, actually, partly because with people wanting to exercise and needing a landscape to exercise in, we certainly weren't, you know, closed or quiet. We had our wider parkland that people, you know, the rights of way and things, they could walk around. So we had a lot of people probably utilising the outside in a way that I think was incredibly beneficial for well-being, I guess, over those years. So that was really important. And we were sort of here just to make sure that was all working well and we were providing that access. But a core team of us also stayed working to keep the water checks happening, to keep the maintenance working. And more than that, we had a little activity teams put together to come up with plans for what would happen post-COVID. So I think we took it as a chance to really review our visitor offer. We'd done a review around 2019 to look at, you know, what would the next 5 years be. And it was a chance to really pause and reflect on what spaces did we have? What was our audience profile? How could we best serve that audience with new exhibitions, enhanced areas? And I think we did an awful lot of work in that time. We moved our catering, one of our cafes, into a larger space, opening up a courtyard that wasn't sort of used so much before. We created a new route into the gardens that was entirely accessible for the first time. We created a new Churchill exhibition, which going from a small space to a much larger space, and with new exhibits within it. We redesigned our stables and got those back to their original sort of style. And in fact, only this week we found some plaques for horse names that have been found in a cupboard that will be going back into those stables. So it's an ongoing thing as well. But and we were looking at sort of how would people behave post-COVID. We created lots of outdoor seating, some extra areas. And since then, with a sort of a real understanding that the audience profile is shifting a little bit more, we had many more families over that over those years. We have now created an adventure play area, a fantastic, actually, new adventure play that's within a little walled garden of its own, and is so exciting. We launched it last year. It's had a year of running, and that is really designed to give an offer to those families, particularly local families that might want to come back regularly. And it also spreads the footfall, because we can't keep developing things simply within the state rooms. There's only so much space, and we need to maintain and you know, obviously conserve our collections. So by just developing and utilising our spaces well, hopefully we're giving lots of new things to the audience, but also making sure we're protecting the palace in doing it that way.
Very good, very good. So you've been there for 5 years now, and you've come to work at the palace most days, I'm guessing. What's your favourite object that you sort of walk past every day, or favourite part of the palace that you go, oh, this is nice, this makes it all worth it?
It's a tough one, because I think anybody that works at Blenheim, the second you sort of are stepping across the landscape, it's everything. It all has such a power on you, and I don't think you ever get bored of the views, the buildings. I think probably even the collection, it probably changes, because with the light, with the different activities we do, different rooms shine in some ways. But I think probably thinking about this, probably there's a portrait by McAvoy of Consuelo Vanderbilt, the first wife of the ninth Duke. That's in one of our corridors that I probably walk past certainly every day. It's a very large portrait. It's very arresting. It's sort of that late 1800s, early 1900s style. That's probably my favourite era. And I just love it. And I can't walk past it without just pausing and sort of giving her a little nod before I then head off to do whatever I'm going to do. So that's probably the one I'd pick.
Very good answer, very good answer. Because she was such an important figure in the history of Blenheim, wasn't she, Consuelo Vanderbilt? Can you tell us a little bit about her?
She was. Well, yes, I mean, the ninth Duke sort of inherited a palace that needed investment, certainly. And I think by marrying a Vanderbilt, obviously that opportunity came, and then, you know, the money rolled in for a while. And absolutely, I think by marrying Consuelo, that allowed developments that we now take for granted. We've got the water terraces, we've got the Italian garden. There's areas that were, throughout the state rooms that were, renewed and altered because of that. And it was a great chance to sort of reinvest and redevelop Blenheim across that sort of early 20th century. But I think also she's a really interesting character, and I think she was very well loved by the local community as an individual. I think there's some lovely stories about her. The Glitter and the Gold is a book I still mean to read, and I haven't done yet. And I've just got to have a holiday where I can take it away with me, because I certainly would like to learn a bit more of the detail as well.
And in 1987, the house was designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. What does that sort of mean in terms of the day-to-day running of the building? What do you have to do to keep it? Are there UNESCO inspectors who sort of show up to make sure that everything is as it was? Or
certainly not on a regular basis. So we're not fearful of anyone.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. They, we certainly need to ensure that we maintain things as is expected to retain that status. And I think, we want to retain and enhance the status as much as we can. But on a practical terms, I've already talked about parking, simple things like that. Sometimes we know why we're doing things, but perhaps the public might not realise. So when we have 6,000 people turn up for a busy day on Easter weekend, we have one hard standing car park that probably fits about 300 cars.
Yeah.
And normally in normal weather, if we're into the main season, we would park people on grass, and that would be actually quite pleasant. But when the weather's not so good, it's either a case of parking people on the grass and potentially towing them out, or it's parking them on roadways, because that's the only hard standing we have. And that's, of course, because as a World Heritage Site, we can't suddenly design a huge new hard standing car park.
Yeah.
If we were to do that, we'd soon, I think, get that visit that you suggest. So we need to always be mindful of what we can do, and make sure we do things absolutely to the very best standards at all times.
Very good. Well, one more question for you. What's your favourite part of the job?
I think it is seeing the guests, and them just seeing guests have a fantastic time. I really think that as much as we can plan and it's wonderful being creative, and I love the idea of working with the team to come up with an exhibition or running a really fun event where there's loads of energy to it, or running a function in the evening that might have, you know, stars and celebrity. You know, there's lots of things that make it amazing. But there's nothing better than just talking to perhaps a family that have driven for a couple of hours to come and visit you, and they are infused and really excited. And for them, this is a once in a lifetime experience. And just knowing that we've got that right, I think those moments are always, you know, that's what makes it really worthwhile.
Very good. Well, it sounds like an extremely rewarding place to work, Old Blenheim. So thank you very much for giving us some of your time to sort of show us behind the scenes of what it's like to run one of Britain's biggest houses. Thank you so much for coming, Emily. It's been really, really, really enlightening.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you very much, as always, to our listeners. Thank you very much to the amazing Toby Keel, our editor and producer. And I will be back next week. Thank you very much.